Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behaviour in a business context. Season 3 is all about behaviour at work, how people show up, how managers lead, and how organisations build high performance cultures. We're speaking with senior leaders to uncover the thinking that drives behaviour, the trends shaping management development, and the future of work in an ever-changing world. In this episode of Misbehave, we're joined by Catherine Douglas, former Chief People and Sustainability Officer at the Cooperative Bank and a founding member of the Nexus Chief People Forum. She shares how clarity of purpose can guide decision-making and prevent conflict, whether choosing a supplier or leading change. Catherine emphasises the importance of honest, visible leadership during major transitions to build trust and reduce rumours. She also busts the myth that sustainability is just a cost, showing how it can drive innovation, strengthen reputation, and cut long-term costs. Join us to learn how purpose, transparency, and rethinking sustainability can help leaders navigate today's complex business landscape. Welcome, Catherine. We're very excited to have you here today on our podcast. I'd like to kick off with a pretty big question, really. We know that you've had a very varied career, and one of the key things that kind of runs through that is that you have had the opportunity to work for purpose-led organisations. Can you tell me a little bit about how you have seen purpose move from something that was really more aspirational to something more operational?
Yeah, definitely. So I think, you know, certainly one of the brands that I have worked for is very purpose-driven and purpose-led, and had a very strong customer ethical policy as well, which, you know, when I joined the organisation, very quickly realised that ran through the whole, you know, the DNA of the bank, really. And everything that the strategy was built on was built around that customer ethical policy, which was fantastic. So whether that was when we were thinking about new products or propositions, to the systems we implemented and suppliers that we used as well, there was a really sort of strong brand awareness around, you know, that ethical piece really, and that purpose-led strategy, which was great. And I think what I very quickly saw was that people really held each other to account. Yeah, you know, our customers and colleagues had expectations of us around that. And that was everything that we had to consider. And we had to make some tough decisions sometimes around it. But I think that was always at the forefront of the mind. And I think that ran from the board, from the CEO, you know, right down throughout the organisation. And I think colleagues were very passionate about it as well. And hence the reason why they worked for that organisation.
And have you seen over your roles and the organisations that you've worked in, have you seen like a change in people's attitude to that?
Yes, definitely. And I think people are definitely more aware of it. And I think obviously now, because of certain regulations that are in place as well, then people are paying a lot more attention to it. I feel the organisations I've worked for have always had that in place. It's probably just now got a label of what they've actually been achieving and what they're actually doing. And I think it's very, very clear that, you know, this is what, you know, there is a lot of customers out there that really want to be with sustainable brands. Really important to businesses, to small businesses, to customers, and certainly it was to colleagues.
It's interesting. I was at an event yesterday where we were talking about kind of making your North Star, your purpose, really visible, and not just connecting it from a company standpoint, but making sure that you connect it from a customer standpoint. And sometimes businesses do one or the other. They make it very customer-centric or they make it very company-centric. And that can be confusing, sort of internally and externally. And that was really interesting, the conversation that came out from that. One of the things that is tricky is obviously for leaders to then stay anchored to that and to really stay connected to the values and make the right call, really. How have you experienced that with the leaders that you're nurturing, you know, that you're managing?
Yes, I think you make a really good point. And there were several occasions that, you know, I've seen that sort of play out, particularly when you're looking at new products and propositions, for example. And I think Again, it comes back to, I've already said this, it is about holding each other to account. And I think just remembering the organization that you're working for and actually what are their values? What is their purpose? And, you know, and how does that sort of link into the strategy? We had a great example once with a product that we were really keen to launch. It was a product that customers wanted us to launch as well. And we knew that there was a desire and a need from customers. And we went out to a third party to help us with that particular product. But actually, because of our onboarding processes, that we had at the bank, and because of our ethical policy, it meant that we couldn't go with this particular provider. And actually, it was a really cut and dry decision, because once we realised that they didn't meet our standards and our criteria, it was just, you know, we walked away from it straight away. Now, obviously, the challenge we had was communicating that to the customers. But I think because through the customer-led ethical policy, we knew exactly what our customers wanted from us. So it made that communication easier. And then we had to, but it was harder from a colleague point of view, because we had to go find an alternative that actually met the needs of our ethical policy.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one of the biggest challenges we see with the businesses that we work with is making those purpose statements or North Stars or where you're driving from connected to everybody, so yeah, that people, you know, if you ask the question sometimes, what's your purpose? People go, oh, I think we've recently changed it and I can't really remember what it is. And it's not through, it's like being able to bring it to life. That's the difficult piece. And then it almost being that statement or sentiment that you cross-check decisions against. Like you said, that piece around, oh, can we work with this third party or a supplier? Well, actually, if we cross-check against that purpose, if it's a no, then it's kind of an obvious, it's an obvious decision. And I think, you know, I'm definitely an advocate for that in business, where you have really clear either a KPI or a thematic goal that you're working towards. And then, because often we can get distracted or we get swayed by other things, you know, surplus to sort of the requirement, and you start to make decisions that aren't fixed to that purpose. So yeah, really interesting. Where have you found in your career where it's worked really, really well, and where maybe in your experience it's been much more difficult?
Yeah, certainly. So I think my last role, when, you know, was working for the bank, I think it worked incredibly well. But as I said, it was a really key part of their DNA, and they've been doing that for a number of years. I suppose when I look back to my earlier stage careers, perhaps didn't work as well, but I don't think it was as much as a heightened kind of topic then. And there was a lot of people now talking around sustainability, ESG, and how we need to come together and to be that sort of force for good. Whereas I've felt that, you know, the bank has always had that. That was always their USP, I suppose, if you like. That was always what they wanted to be known for. And I feel do it incredibly well. So I think others are now definitely following suit.
For sure. We're seeing much more of that, where it becomes more of the DNA within an organisation. Yeah.
That doesn't happen overnight either. So I think, and I think you really have to, everybody in the organisation, and I think it does start from that top level, have absolutely got to buy into it and believe in it. And I think, you know, I saw, you know, colleagues come to the bank who hadn't sort of worked for, or maybe didn't have those kind of ethical values themselves, and really struggled with it because it was such a strong part of the culture. It was the culture. You know, we did a lot of surveys around, you know, why colleagues worked with us and banked with us, and, you know, customers, why customers and business banks, and it all came back to that ethical policy and the standards that we set ourselves as an organisation, that's what people were buying into.
Yeah, I mean, often I think leaders can underestimate sort of the complexity of delivering like a sustainable promise. It's like you have a sustainability promise, it's then how do you then deliver on that? And what's your experience of that, where you felt leaders have really not understood or underestimated the complexity of that?
So I think it comes down to that constant communication as well. And I think when you have got a very clear strategy in place and you are making public commitments to your customers and to businesses, then that's what you have to stand behind. And I think, yeah, don't get me wrong, there can be heated conversations behind the scenes, yeah, to get the outcome that we absolutely need to get. And if you have come from an environment where the sort of sustainability isn't as strong, and you now have to factor that into every decision that you make, then that can be frustrating for some people. But I'd say that was very few and far between that we saw those instances, because I come back to the point, I think a lot of colleagues work for the bank because they liked the ethical part that the bank was promoting. It's about that sustainable brand again, isn't it? And doing the right things externally, really trying to make that difference in the communities that you're working in. And working with organisations for a greater common good. So, we worked with some big charity partners, to do campaigning to really push the political agenda in certain areas as well. And I suppose we were very bold about that as well. But I think the great thing is our customers hold us to account, and that's what's really important.
I love that. I think, the accountability piece is critical for the execution, because ultimately you can have lots of great ideas and you can have aspirations, but they can drift. And if there's not those strong accountability check-ins, and whether that's internal stakeholders, external stakeholders, I think, we see that where people have great aspirations, but then they get busy doing other things. I think in a banking environment or a financial institute, your commitments are potentially more public. But for organizations where maybe the declarations are more internal, they can often slip. You mentioned earlier very briefly about the onboarding process of people into the organization. Is there anything that you do to ensure that people are coming into the organization, you're recruiting on the base of the right values and the right culture in order to help that from sort of the execution of things from top all the way throughout the organization?
Yeah, so I think it does. You have to pay attention to that onboarding process, and I think you have to give both parties, so the potential colleague that's joining you and the organisation, time to really get to know each other and really help them understand what your organisation is all about, really. So I think the more people that they can meet within that organisation. I mean, prior to me joining the bank, I met several people, and it was really great because I think when you're meeting people, I suppose this is a challenge nowadays because a lot of meetings could be over Teams or Zoom. But I think when you get that face-to-face interaction as well, you can very quickly see if somebody is buying into it, and I think you get that real genuine reaction to what you need people to do and what the bank's all about, to be honest.
And I suppose it's creating space where you can, and I know this isn't always possible for people to actually spend time in a less pressured environment than just an interview, where they can actually get a feel for the organisation and people at different levels and maybe cross-function.
Exactly, definitely, and definitely spending time in the organisation, meeting different people, as you say, right across different teams that they're potentially going to interact with. Just, and I think it's great for a potential colleague as well to see the true sort of organisation, really, rather than just in that interview scenario.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons I know before we spoke with you, you filled in our behavioural profile. And it's one of the reasons we're massive advocates of introducing that at onboarding stage, well, recruitment and then onboarding, because you can really get an understanding of whether the role's a good fit for the person based on their behavioural preferences and their strengths. And also for them, for us to get to know them on an interactive personal level. But that kind of helps short circuit some of the time that it would take for you to get to know someone on a behavioural level. Interestingly, you've had quite a varied career pathway from starting out in management and working in more retail, working then right through to a number of different banks and in a lot of different roles. Tell me a little bit about how you found that transition from sort of some of the management roles that you took and then moving into more senior director level MD roles. How was that transition for you?
Yeah, so I think every role I've learned something different. I think every day is a school day, isn't it? I think I still learn every day now, which is great. And, I don't feel that I know all the answers to everything. I'm very, my style is very collaborative. I know you've touched on my personal profile that sort of came through, and I think I do like to involve people and the teams that work with me and teams I work for as well, to get people's different views and opinions. So I suppose, when I very first started out in my very first career, it's more of probably general management kind of role. And I think what a great grounding that has given me for my career. because it was a very much a general management role. I was running some stores, they were P&L based. So, you know, it's almost like I was running my own business, and I was health and safety, and I was HR, and I was, you know, products and propositions, etc. So I think that was a really great grounding for me. And I think retail gave me that great grounding that then I could transition into sort of a financial services environment, where I could use some of those skills. And I think then you just develop your own leadership skills and your own leadership style. And I think you take things from all the different leaders and managers that you've worked with and for. So I think that's how it's helped me. I mean, I didn't have any kind of set career in mind. I think opportunities have come my way that, you know, I've had the opportunity to apply for, or I've had a bit of a tap on the shoulder for. And I think, you know, latterly in my career, I've had very broad roles as well. So I've worked for smaller organisations, but a real breadth of role. And I personally really thrive on that and love that. And it's not for everybody, you know, but it does still give you, you know, great opportunity to work, roll your sleeves up when the time's needed, but also then to be able to take a step back because and realise that, you know, you are the person that's driving that strategy as well, and making sure that, you know, the business is staying on track with what we need to deliver.
I mean, I have so much synergy with your story because I actually started out in retail, and it was a brand new store that had opened, and I was given almost the reins of the store, and I was the, you know, the merchandiser, the hirer, the manager, but it gave me so much breadth to be able to empathize with people in different roles, but also having really early responsibility for, you know, the financial viability of the business at such a young age, which was really interesting. And I think, although I didn't stay on in a retail environment, it gave me such great groundings for moving forward in different roles and definitely taking the opportunities where they come. And I'm a massive believer of that. I know some of the listeners will be thinking, you know, how do you create the opportunities? But often I think if you're the sort of person and you are, your behavioral profiles definitely suggests collaboration, building relationships. Sometimes those things nothing comes from them. They don't come to fruition straight away, but things might come a knocking at a later stage, or where you can go back to people across your career because you've created really great relationships and lean on those.
If you're interested in learning more about your own management behaviours and the behaviours of your team, click the link in the show notes to access a 14-day free trial of Perform.
I mean, just to know, how did you make the decision to move into the financial services? Was that by chance? Was it an opportunity, as you mentioned, or was it something that was a bit more ambitious and you were targeting?
So, no, it was just by chance, and it was somebody that approached me. And that's how I sort of got into financial services, which was great. I mean, it was a baptism of fire for my first year. I'm not going to lie, because obviously, you know, banking and the financial services at the time I moved into it was very heavily sales focused. As well. But I think that retail background, as you've sort of described, I think definitely really helped me as well. And I went into like an area role as well. So I was responsible for 16 bank branches and estate agencies as well. So it was a steep learning curve that first year, but absolutely loved it.
I imagine. And that kind of takes us nicely into just, I want to spend a little bit of time asking you about sort of, I suppose, the acquisition and culture. So you've been involved in a number of different acquisitions, and they're common in banking, we know that, but they often fail on the people side. So from experience, certainly from us, we've worked with clients where they've done an acquisition and it's almost been like a clash of culture, where, you know, one of the biggest challenges is merging two cultures with two, maybe even different operational stances, but also the cultural piece has been where people really don't gel, and they end up, you know, either leaving or performance tanks because it takes too long for people to combine the culture. I'm interested to know a little bit about your experience with that, and what do you think are the biggest risks to culture during like an integration period? How can that be managed well?
I think it does come down to communication, and I think you've got to have strong communication. I think colleagues and customers as well want to understand what's going on. So I think prior to, you know, the last acquisition that we did, I felt that both the bank and the acquirer were very strong with the communications, and we worked on that together. We were very clear and keen that customers sort of knew what was going to happen, timescales that might happen in, but particularly colleagues as well, because it's that colleague engagement piece, isn't it? Because I think what you see is that, you know, that excitement that something is happening. And I think for the organisation I worked with, there was a lot of press speculation and that we were up for sale. So I think for colleagues to actually get that clarity to say, yes, actually, we are going to, you know, we are going to be acquired, we are selling the bank. But I think the cultural fit of the organisation we were selling to was really strong as well. So I think that massively helped. And I think, you know, the CEO of the acquirer was very vocal, very prominent to colleagues as well, as was the CEO of the bank. So there was a lot of roadshows that were done to, you know, and I think it was just a very much open scenario where colleagues could ask any question that they wanted of the CEO of the bank. And he was sort of very open with his answers as well, because I think we were all very aware that it very quickly turns to with colleagues, so what does it actually mean for me? And the number one question they have is, am I going to lose my job? So I think it's about helping them understand, okay, what is the process that we need to go to actually sell the bank? So a lot of communication prior to the sale. And then we considered, you know, that first sort of 4 to 6 weeks, I think there was a lot of colleague roadshows done, a lot of face-to-face visits into all the key sites, was a lot of branch visits done as well, so that, you know, branch colleagues felt that they'd been communicated with. And it's that communication piece that's absolutely critical, and honesty. Yeah. And I think, again, you know, the acquirer was very honest with colleagues as well, particularly around timescales, to say, this is how long we believe that it's going to take us to fully integrate the two organisations. Yeah. And these things do take time. But actually, from a colleague and a culture and an engagement perspective, we can do these things very, very quickly. So I've seen it done incredibly well. And hopefully over time, we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. I mean, I think you mentioned two critical pieces. The first is that, you know, the two organisations are aligned in the first instance in the ways that where it's important. I mean, you can't be fully aligned operationally, but certainly from a point of view of culture, value, and maybe vision. And I think if you can do that, and that's often the bit where maybe an organization, a large organization, has taken over a smaller one. We've seen it where it's too far apart for them to be able to become aligned. And that's been the due diligence ahead of time hasn't been quite right. But the second piece around the communication, there's a lovely line we often use when we're working with managers and leaders of organizations. We'll say often they want to hold back the communication because they don't have it all nailed down yet. But what happens is, we say, like, if you don't control the narrative, someone else will. And what tends to happen is particularly with more reflective, detailed people, they will fill in the gaps. They won't just move forward with what they've got. And often the hesitancy to announce what you know and just acknowledge, we don't know it all yet, but we will tell you as soon as we do, that can be so reassuring for people.
Oh, absolutely. And that feedback came back to us as an executive team very, very quickly. Once we'd announced, obviously, the bank was, you know, was going to sell, and we knew who we were going to sell to. And I think we had a sort of a period where it was quieter for colleagues. And I think the feedback we got from colleagues is, just tell us. If there's nothing to tell us, just tell us there's nothing to tell us. But don't say nothing, because you're absolutely right. They'll fill in the blanks themselves. It's like, well, is it still going ahead? Is it not going ahead? And obviously, with these kind of acquisitions as well, there's a lot of confidentiality. So there's only, you know, there's things that can be said and can't be said. But I think being honest and timely, I think, is really valuable for that colleague engagement piece.
Yeah, lovely sort of takeaways from that. I think the other thing is what's interesting, often people who are in senior positions, and you're one of them and so am I, we have a behavioral strength, which is we call big picture. And that is where you're often more visionary. So you can see the end goal really easily without having all the how and the what between where you are now and where you need to go. And you're more comfortable with not knowing all of that before you get started. So you can certainly see where you're heading. But often where it falls down in communication is that you then go and give the big picture. And for the people who need more of the how and the what, the detail, and maybe more process, that can often be lacking in the over, you know, the initial communication, because you don't personally need it, so therefore you don't give it, you know. And obviously the more sophisticated you get, the more you kind of understand the need for that. But as leaders, sometimes we will operate in a way that works for us, and if we don't need that, we, you know, we can almost be oblivious to it or dismissive of it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'd probably say I quickly realised with the comms, because that was part of my remit as well, around sort of internal and external comms, that we needed to be very mindful of everything you've just said, really, because this was impacting people's lives, and people want to know. And I think it's the timeline, that if they just understand the timeline of what's coming next, then I think it just helps give them some clarity in their mind as well. And do, as you say, very much want to understand. So how is it going to operate when we have the acquisition, and when we come together as two organizations and we're going onto a new IT platform? Yeah, are you changing our contracts? Are you am I going to be made redundant? Are the two teams coming together? So there's a lot of operational things that they needed to understand. But I think we were very clear in that timeline that this will take X amount of months, this might actually take years to do, and this is why. And I think giving them the why as well just helps them understand.
Yeah. And I think, we're talking about acquisitions there, which are often big things. And, there'll be a lot of our listeners aren't really thinking about acquisitions, but this conversation applies to pieces of change within your organization. Whether that's, it could just be a change in the management structure, it could be an additional site, it might be that you're scaling and that is going to impact change on an operational level. So I think the same principles apply regardless of how significant the change is. And often for people, it's like you say, their initial thought will be, what does this mean for me? And that's when the fear factor kicks in. So addressing fear, fear is just the things that you're predicting that might happen. That's where fear comes from. So often if you can just reassure where you can, I think that goes a long way on any level of change, So in your view, what should leaders pay close attention to if we were to look at like a 90-day sprint? So post-acquisition, to ensure sort of that performance, the trust is all aligned and stays intact. What tips could you give in that first 90-day piece?
So the first thing I'd probably say is around that senior leader visibility. So get out and about across, both organizations, and be really clear and consistent in the communication that you're giving to both sides. And I think so then the second thing for me is definitely around that communication piece, and being open and honest, give timelines and timescales as to when you think key activity is going to happen. And I think it was really important, so especially where you've got central teams as well, we very quickly got those central teams together so they could meet each other and they could talk about what their priorities were and how some of those priorities were aligned, and how we could sort of share then people and colleagues and processes to really help both sides of the organization to support each other. I mean, to be honest, there was a significant amount of due diligence done before, prior to the acquisition. But then post-acquisition, yeah, it was around that visibility and getting teams together and meeting each other, I think was really, really critical. And I think, we did have a change in management structure, and the CEO obviously went retired for the bank, and obviously the new CEO took over. But he was incredibly visible to all colleagues, visited all the major sites, as I said, went out to meet all the relationship managers, went out, met a lot of the branch managers as well. So just to give them confidence, and that this is the new leader of the bank, this is who we're going to be hearing from. And I think that visibility really, really helps, but also from the senior team, from the acquirer as well, they're all very, very visible, and I think that just allayed some of the fears of colleagues.
Yeah, visibility is the key word there, isn't it? Yeah.
Think that open and honesty as well. So we had very open, CEO roadshows where colleagues could ask questions, and we knew they were going to ask challenging questions and difficult questions, but we didn't shy away from them. And I think that gave an element of reassurance, but then respect that we weren't trying to hide anything. We would tell what we knew, we would tell colleagues.
Yeah. And I think sometimes with the confidentiality bit, because that happens a lot, doesn't it? If you're looking at restructure or potentially redundancies, or it might just be pay scales or whatever in change within an organization, often that's not something you can openly discuss. But I think it's then acknowledging that there are some things we can't share from a legality standpoint, but the things we can, we are going to. And, for me, that acknowledgement goes a long way, regardless of what it's about. It's sometimes just keeping people sort of reassured that you're acknowledging they may have worries about things you can't share, but you will when you can.
I think one thing that we did really well is that both of the internal comms teams worked really closely together to ensure consistency of message, because I think there's nothing worse if one organisation is hearing something different to each other, because you've already alluded to it, then they'll just fill in the gaps and create the story themselves, which is not necessarily true. So the consistency of that message, I think, is absolutely key.
Brilliant. Some brilliant tips there for the listeners on just managing change. I think if they can apply that to any pieces of change, you know, we do a lot of training around just that change transition and how to connect people to strategic thinking when change is happening. So being really open and honest about that, regardless of the level that people work with. But interestingly, you know, our profile does tell you your appetite for change. And we can see from yours, you've obviously have a big appetite for driving change. And it's linked very much to wanting to understand the why. And you alluded to that earlier, the improvements, the benefits, what is it going to allow us to do differently to what we're doing now? And I think connecting that why is super important for people to be able to buy in and get on board. So yeah, some interesting takeaways there. So I'm going to do a quick rapid fire, Catherine. So these are quick questions. So I want you to answer me one leadership habit you swear by.
I think that's fairly easy for me. I think that's consistent reflection. I think I'm constantly reflecting on decisions and actions and their impact that they've had. I think it really helps with my self-awareness. It helps me to make better decisions. And I think it's being that emotional intelligence as well. I think that builds empathy with teams and colleagues and stuff. And I think it does really improve relationships. So, and then finally, I think it just keeps my actions aligned to actually what is the strategy, what's the values, what's the purpose that we're trying to deliver, and helps me achieve those long-term goals.
A behaviour you think is underrated in great leaders?
So I would say active listening. I think the ability to truly listen without interrupting, judging, or immediately jumping into that problem solving piece as well. You know, very early in my career, when I was on some management development, one of the trainers actually said to us, "You've got two ears and one mouth, use them in those proportions." And I think that has really, really stuck with me. And I think that really builds trust, because colleagues feel valued, they feel that they've got a voice as well, and I think it helps with that motivation piece as well, and it encourages great ideas.
The biggest myth about sustainability in business?
I think the biggest myth for me is that it's too costly to implement and it's unprofitable. And I think that, you know, people see it as that it's just increasing costs all the time and expenses, where in the reality, yes, there are some upfront costs, but I think they can lead to longer term savings and that improved efficiency and also help with the brand. We talked about that already. I think, you know, customers really want those sustainable brands. So I think it's great that, you know, companies start to think in this way.
A moment in your career that shaped how you lead today?
So I think this goes back to, again, fairly early in my career. And I had, at the time, I had a very inspirational leader who I think people would have walked over hot coals for, to be honest. And I think that's because I had a very collaborative kind of style. He really gave you a space to be the leader that you wanted to be. And I think you and I both talked about that, working in retail and that general management and really owning that business. But I think, you know, he did listen really well. He was a great coach. But I think ultimately you knew that he would support you. He would back decisions that you made and he would speak up for you. And I think so just his whole style just really sort of shaped the kind of leader that I wanted to aspire to be.
And the final question, the best decision you've made under pressure?
Oh, okay. This is quite a difficult one, but I was trying to think about times in my life and my career where I have really been under pressure. I'd probably say I had an experience of having to run a war room following a huge IT migration that didn't go to plan. And I think that was just a real baptism again of fire for me. And I think So I can't necessarily give one specific example, but I think what I did have to do was I had to give very quick, effective decisions because, you know, this was having huge customer impact. And so to improve that customer experience and the customer service. But I think for me, it was around having to really keep calm. And I had to massively step up as well because it did feel like I was fighting a lot of fires all at once. But again, it came back to that communication point as well, because providing frontline colleagues with the confidence that actually we were working on the systems to get it better, because obviously they were the face to the customer, and customers wanted answers and wanted answers very, very quickly.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Catherine. We've really loved having you on the podcast.
That's great. Thanks very much for inviting me.
So let's wrap up with some key takeaways from today's episode. The first one focuses on how having a clear company purpose can really reduce conflict, particularly surrounding like decision making. Catherine talked about using their key purpose when making critical strategic decisions and shared how they did this right down to selecting suppliers. When you use the purpose as a cross-check, it can really help influence buy-in when cascading what might seem an unpopular decision across the organization. The second point Catherine talked about was the need for open, honest communication and visibility, particularly during major transitions like acquisitions or a strategic pivot. She talked about the importance of being visible as leaders to really address worries directly and cut down on rumors. During times of change, you want people to feel trusted and informed rather than left in the dark. And just remember, if you don't create the narrative, other people will do it on your behalf. The last takeaway addresses the myths often surrounding sustainability in business. If leaders can step away from thinking it's a pure cost and look at how integrating sustainable practice can lead to innovation, long-term cost efficiencies, and as Catherine said, in her experience, significantly enhancing a business's reputation and competitiveness. Often this can result in attracting environmentally conscious customers and investors, increasing both brand loyalty and market competitiveness. Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.